Welcome to the 12-Step Recovery Evolution podcast. Visit recoveryevolution.co.uk for more episodes, helpful resources and links to our social media. Also visit the site for information on how you can attend a future Zoom session or workshop live. Thank you.
Happy Friday, if that is the day, not sure. To check the calendar, they sort of all blend into one, don't they? It kind of takes the fun out of the weekend, really, when you think every day is like a Saturday. But so this group is on Friday. This is just for any questions that you have about what we've talked about in the week before, or if you've got any questions about recovery or anything that you guys want to sort of bring up or mention or even share. I don't really got any plans for the group. It's up to what you guys want to do with it, really. So if anybody has got a question, fire away and we'll do our best to answer it from the recovery point of view or spiritual.
Yeah, I'd like to understand more. I mean, I understand the problem much better since I've been in ECR. But how do you actually deal with the loneliness and the fear around life and what's going on in the world right now?
See, I think what I try not to do, and again, it's quite difficult because I quite like giving solutions, because I think, you know, being a problem person all my life and really still struggling with the problems in life, whether they're like our real problems or they're just my problems or the way that I look at it. And so even like doing that group on, I think that would have been Wednesday. It's like everybody sort of brings their problems, and it's not like I don't want to put myself in a position as somebody that's got all the answers to everybody's problems. That the idea was to try and show you that there is a process that's in the 12-step program, that if you've got problems, you should be in that process. And you should be looking for the solutions, because just having answers to problems doesn't solve them. You know, and that's kind of a difficult thing, I think, sometimes for people to get their head around. That just knowing something doesn't necessarily solve the problem. Just like we're saying, having a gold mine doesn't make you rich. It's only when you start learning how to dig the gold out. Now, people think, oh, I'd love a gold mine. But you may never get that gold to market, because it takes a lot of work to get the gold out of a mine. And if you don't know how to do it, you're never going to get that gold out. So you can come and say, well, I'm broke, but I got a gold mine. What do I have to do? I want the money. And it's like, well, mate, I don't know. You have to learn how to, you know, the health and safety in a gold mine. You need to learn how to use your machinery. You know how to get the gold out of the mine, who to sell it to, is there anything you have to do to sell it? So it sounds like a simple, sometimes just saying, well, this is the problem, what's the solution? And again, I think with people with addiction problems, you know, they do want this instant result, which is kind of what we get from taking drugs and drinking. You get an instant result. Nothing actually changed outside, but I feel great on the inside. You know, that's one of the problems with addiction, isn't it? Is that I learned that I could be lying on the street pissing me pants, but I felt all right. Now, on the inside, I felt great, but on the outside, my life's going to shit. But when you start matching them up with drugs and alcohol, even this is legal drugs as well as illegal drugs or prescribed drugs, that the pain of me not living a very good life or behaving in certain ways is causing me to feel bad on the inside. So if I take painkillers, then I still feel good on the inside, no matter what's going on the outside. And I guess in a way, recovery is kind of proposing that we learn to start resolving them problems on the outside so we don't have to take the painkiller on the inside. And so recovery is kind of like that. Once you get past that beginning, I mean, there's this overemphasis on being abstinent. Again, it's a good thing and it's an important place to start. But it's not the end of the journey. It's the beginning of the journey. And then there's this whole other recovery program that helps us to deal with all these other areas of our life. So, you know, So when you say, you know, Val, sorry, that I'm lonely, there could be lots of reasons for that. You know, it's like when people say, I just want to be happy. Well, usually happiness isn't just one thing. I mean, people like, you know, I'll be happy when I get in a relationship. Well, we all know what, you know, when you get in a relationship, that don't make you happy. It might for a little while, but now you've got things in that relationship you need to address. And then you think, oh, when they stop doing that, I'll be happy. And then they stop doing that. And then they start doing that. And then you think, well, when they start doing that, I'll be happy. And when I get a new fridge, I'll be happy. And you get a new fridge and you feel, oh, I am happy now. 10 minutes later, you're like, I don't feel so happy now. I've just noticed that there's a hole in the carpet. So I'll be happy when I get a hole in the carpet fixed. And that path, you can go on forever. But at some point, you may think, actual fact, the problem of me being happy isn't on the outside. Some of it is, but there's some dissatisfaction on the inside. So again, it's not just easy to give people answers to their problems. And I think that's where society, honestly, I believe this is where society goes wrong. Giving a homeless person food isn't necessarily solving their problem. It just isn't. Giving people food in food banks isn't necessarily solving their problem. Because I want to be able to say to people, well, why haven't you got any food? I got food. Why haven't you got any food? Now, there could be lots of reasons not to have food. And some of them can be just complete misfortune. That I've just had such bad misfortune that I've got no food. But I'd argue that's probably not the case for most people. For one, what level of education do you have? Now, I know people, well, it's a bit judgmental. It's like, well, not really, because if you're going to have a decent job that's going to pay you well, you've got to have a reasonable level of education. So not being judgmental, it's realistic in this world, isn't it? Well, I can't get educated because of this problem. It's like, well, all right, well, then we need to move that problem out of the way, because we know that if you're going to get a good job and going to get a decent income, that's not just going to happen. There's certain things you're going to have to do. You're going to have to learn, you know, people who don't get up in the morning don't, and even they may have a great level of education, but if you don't get up in the morning and get to work, you're going to lose your job. You're going to probably end up with a food bank. But giving you food ain't going to solve the problem. Learning to get up in the morning is going to solve your problem, or finding what is it. And then they might say, these are all just examples I'm throwing out there, that people might say, oh, well, you know, I'm playing video games till 3 a.m. Well, it's like, well, why are you playing video games? Well, because of this. And you have to keep going back till you get to the root of the problem. And the evidence that the problem's been resolved is the fact that they go to bed at a reasonable time, they get up, they go and earn a living, and they don't get run out of money. They don't need to go to the food bank. And so there's lots of reasons why people are in the situation that they're in, but they're all could be in the same situation for different reasons. So, you know, I kind of feel society has this idea that, you know, one solution's going to solve all the problems. Well, I'm more of a person that's like saying, look, if you're struggling, because I've learned through the 12-step program, I've learned working with all these people that having, I think addiction is identical problem in everybody, but then you've got this outside circumstances that can change from person to person. So when you're doing infantry, you're trying to look at it, what is it in you that is blocking you off? And so if you're use the example of I'm lonely, it's like, well, what is actually causing that? Because there could be lots of causes for that and things that you may have to change. I mean, I don't get bored. I mean, I don't ever remember being bored. Because it's like, my trouble is, it's like, there's so much to do. Even when I'm sitting in my own mind, on my own in a chair, there's so much in my mind that I want to think about. I don't have time to think about everything. If you get to know me, one of the things you'll probably notice is, I don't want to think about that right now. Because I realise I've only got a certain capacity to think. And when you're like the director of a rehab, people keep asking me questions, and then I have to think about that while I'm trying to think about that. So, you know, I've learned, funny enough, big part of my job is actually thinking. And again, I might be sitting there with my feet on the table looking like I'm doing nothing, but I'm thinking. It takes a bit of time to do some thinking, because then I might have to go and ask some questions. Then I might have to go and, you know, read up something and learn something and to find out what how I'm going to do what I'm going to do. So no, I don't sound like I'm rambling. The point I'm making is, Val, is that I just there's not an answer to give you. The point is learning how to do a good infantry with your sponsor. But the question should be, why am I lonely? What is the cause of my loneliness? And what can I do to change it? Because look, for example, people have said that to me in the past. They've said, well, I'm lonely. I'm like, well, why don't you go up to church then? Well, I believe in all that. Well, go to a charity shop then. Well, yeah, I don't feel comfortable about that. Well, whatever you say to them, they're not going to do it. And then it starts becoming apparent why they're sitting at home on their own. But then you're going, mate, you've got to kind of be willing to make some changes. You know, it's like, you know, you can kind of look into people's lives. And for me, doing this process, it's kind of easy to see why a lot of people end up where they end up. And it's like, look, if you can't change them behaviours, if you can't get a better process in place, you're going to keep getting the same consequences. So for years, whenever people phone up, they're always the same. I'm suffering from consequences. Can you remove the consequences? And it's like, well, not really, because they're the consequences of your actions. Until you change them actions, you're going to keep getting them consequences. But they're like, I really like them actions. And I'm like, mate, I really like them actions. But I don't like them consequences, so I don't do them actions. And they're like, well, how do I keep doing the actions and not have the consequences? It's like, well, like I was saying about pissing your pants in the town. You can't. What you can do is you can keep doing the actions. You're going to get the consequences. And then you can take painkillers that will make you believe you're not getting the consequences, but you are getting the consequences. You all get the consequences. We all get the consequences. Nobody can be escaped from the consequences, because it's built into the fabric of the universe. And that goes into way down into the things you can't see. And that's where spirituality gets really wonderful, because the more you get off the surface and start looking lower, you start realizing that there's all this stuff going on that you can't see, that you're actually setting in motion, like it says in the big book, that fear is a thief. It sets in motion trials of circumstances we felt we didn't deserve, but we can't see it until someone points it out. And they're like, look, all that stuff in your life is coming out of yourself. It's coming out of your selfishness, your self-centeredness, your self-seeking. And them horrible feelings that you're getting are probably a consequence of that. So learning to do good infantry is what's most important.
Sorry.
Somebody's unmiked. That's it. So you see what I'm saying, Val? I know that might not help, but that form that I give you is to look on there and to start working with a good sponsor. To say, what is it in this world that I can do to alleviate this feeling of loneliness? And I'm sure there's lots you can do.
Well, normally I'm at the charity shop. This normally keeps me busy. On the Sundays, I used to go to church. So I always kept myself busy in that way. Now, yesterday, I was in an excellent mood because my friend was coming for dinner. I love cooking.
Yeah.
So somebody said to me, cook me a meal. Oh, that makes me very happy, because I'm doing something.
Yeah.
When I'm not doing anything, that's when the boredom and loneliness comes in.
Yeah. My mum does all that. My mum, she cooks cakes and she leaves them on the doorstep and phones her friends and they walk by and they pick up cakes. She makes pasties and phones loads of people up and they come and pick up pasties, and then some of them drop flour off, and then they drop sewing off, and she does sewing for them.
well, I can't do this one, I can't do the baking. Like a couple of days ago, my friend asked to make some oxtail and butter beans for her. I was happy to do that. I was happy the whole day. And then Pauline...
That's the thing I'm saying is, without doing proper infantry, your brain is going to keep telling you what you can't do.
What we
want to discover is what you can do. That's the solution.
You're baking never my strong point, but cooking, oxtail, beef, curry, goat, things like that. If you say do that for you, I'd be happy. I'd be so happy.
So then how about, by over the weekend, have you got any friends that you can cook and leave for them or they can pick up?
Yeah, like Pauline came yesterday.
Well, that's the sort of the program then. It says when we get into self, we look at how we can get out of that place and turn our attention to helping others. See, I've found that. That's why I'm never bored, because I like helping people. And look, this world, there's no end of people that need help.
Yeah, because I love helping people, you know.
Oh, well, now you... So think then how you can use this time to stop thinking about yourself and start thinking how you can help others. Then you start lifting, the boredom starts lifting.
Yeah, but I mean, they called me from the charity shop yesterday. They're open to reopen by the 1st of June. So I'm hoping that's going to happen, because that would be one of my boredoms.
Yeah, cool. But you see the point. You see the point I'm making.
Yeah.
Start looking at how we can change the situation. And again, I found in my life that most things can be changed. Some things can't be changed. But then I have to stop trying to change it. And then the moment I realise that and accept it, then that stops causing me suffering as well.
Yeah,
it's such a wonderful program that we do infantry, and it helps us decide. I mean, it always comes down to that, is what do I need to change and what do I need to accept? And if I need to change something, then there's usually things I need to learn that I don't know. And that's when I have to go and get books, or go and speak to people, or go and on a course, or go, you know, on a workshop, or go to college, or you know, watch stuff on YouTube. It's usually something that I need to learn, and then I humble myself, it allows me to learn it. And then when I learn it, my situation changes. And again, for me, the evidence is why I like the three columns. I mean, on the one that we kind of do in our workshop, I put four columns in it, because the fourth column is we want you to put the outcome in it, because the outcome becomes the goal. And I'm not gonna stop my journey until I get the outcome. See, I've learned in my life that even though I have a goal, the goal might be far out of my reach, and I might have to go through many different processes before I'm able to get that process. But if I keep my mind set on the final goal, and then I go through all the many different journeys. Like people might say, oh, my dream is, I dream about having a coffee shop. And it's like, well, you can't just have a coffee shop. There's a lot you need to learn to have a coffee shop. You need to learn about staff, management, coffee, cleaning, health and safety. You know, if you don't learn all the important stuff of how to run a coffee shop, you may get a coffee shop, but it won't be a very pleasant experience and you won't keep it for very long. But if the main event is the coffee shop, and you're willing to take the coffee shop without the process, then it's not going to be a very good coffee shop. Again, it's always coming back to that realistic. You can have really big dreams as long as they're realistic, but then time is going to take a thing. And again, I found with people in addiction, they very rarely have a realistic idea of time. They, you know, I even say jokingly that book, you know, The Power of Now, I say, that's not a really good book for drug addicts and alcoholics. I'm going to write another one, because I don't think now's fast enough. I'm going to call mine The Power of Right Now, because they seem to want everything right now. They're not willing to delay the gratification. They want gratifying and satisfaction now. They're not willing to delay gratification. And that's a big problem with people like us, that some gratification comes after a period of difficulty, a period of suffering, and a period of hard work. And then we're like, well, I don't want all that stuff before it, keep it. And so, you know, this is something that you learn by good infantry, that for me to be in relationships, in my personal life and in business and in family and friends, that there's certain things that I need to have let go of and things I need to improve about myself. I need to give, like we talked about, and I think next week's really going to be more about that, is being able to give better value to the people in my life. And obviously, the more value you give, the deeper and the better your relationships become. But again, there's a lot to that. So I hope that answers your question. Val, who's next?
I've got Tracy, and then it's going to be Jody. So I'll go to Tracy first.
Morning. Got a bit of fear around this, really. I just really want to share what I think what I got out of this week, really. The fears thing, obviously, and I'm doing my step five fears. And anyway, so just this is what sort of went on for me. Sort of, I went to bed last night, done inventory, which I thought I'd done really, really well personally, but maybe I didn't after what Lester's just said, but you have to learn, don't you? And I had some fears, right? Obvious fears, really. I saw, to be fair, shared them with James, you know, and then that's not going to do it, is it? Do you know what I mean? Not only is it selfish, but, you know, he can't fix them because they're my fears. And I woke up in the middle of the night and, you know, I'm sitting there trying to think about them and work them out. So I woke up this morning, I still got the same fears, you know, and then I realised, you know what, they're your fears. So I remember, like Lester saying, if we go through the process, so, you know, the obvious process, I'll do my awakenings, which I do every morning. But I didn't do them any differently. But when I read the awakenings, and when I read Just for Today, and when I read the prayers I was reading, as much as it was a bit selfish, it was like asking for guidance to get over this fear. Look at my defects that are causing these fears. And actually in the daily reflections, it was look at your defects. And then when I asked God to, like, just guide me how to deal with the fear. Where do I need to go? How can I resolve it? And in my reading, it was like, you know, go to people out there that can help you. So, yeah, all right, my sponsor. But, you know, other people that are involved in relationships, other people that understand codependency, which I know I suffer with really badly. You know, some other people have been helping me a lot this week. And I don't know, I can't explain it to you. I just got a lot of peace around it, and it just made me feel, I don't know. I just got something from it, and I'm not fearful of it now. I've got some sort of idea of where I need to go and what to do with it. And also the realisation is, like, it's not going to happen overnight. I've only got to do it today to my best ability. And then again, you know, tonight, look at that inventory and see if what I've done was the right thing to do to help me, and then start again tomorrow. I don't know if any of that made any sense to anybody, but that's the best way I can explain it.
Well, what you were just saying there, let me just look. Oh no, it's back in it. How it works. Sorry for keeping it. It says, we review our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We ask ourselves why we had them. Kind of did that. Self-reliance, it wasn't because self-reliance had failed us. So we started to see that self-reliance was as good as far as it went, but didn't go far enough. Some of us had great self-confidence, probably you. But it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other one. It made us cocky or worse, which is probably you.
Thanks, Lester.
Well, it's the book, not me.
It's true. It's true. I'll take
it that. It says, perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis of trusting and relying upon God. So you started to do that, didn't you?
I did. Absolutely, I did.
All right. We trusted in God rather than ourselves, our finite self. So you're starting to do that. We're in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to that extent, do we do that? Do we think he would help us match? I'll get this in my mind and I'll read and it comes out of my mind as well. Just to the extent that as we do think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he help enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologise for anyone depending on their creator. We laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust in their God. We never apologise for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear, which he did. Yeah?
Yeah, I did.
And direct our thinking, which started to happen, didn't it?
It did.
And then at once we started to outgrow the fear. That happened, didn't it?
It did.
So what was you doing this morning?
Well, doing my awakenings and...
Well, you're practicing a program.
Yeah.
And it worked. And it worked, didn't it?
It flipping did. To be honest with you, it made me cry.
Yeah, but there's still more work to do. But at least you've got a bit of it now down. Yeah. Now we know that works. You just demonstrated it to everybody. That you actually understood, trusted this process, and it worked. But now it's going to show you how to start making the amends if you're willing to keep trusting the process.
I am.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't.
Exactly. So then you'll start to change, and some of them problems that you're putting into this process, you'll start overcoming them. But it is a process, and it's not just going to happen overnight. But you've just learned a little bit more about how to practice this program, and we know it works. You just demonstrated that. But it's still now, there's the next bits to it that you've got to start, keep moving in that direction. Everything you said, finding other people that understand this, people that can help give you guidance. You know, and again, we all want guidance until there's a behavior that we don't want to stop, and then we don't want the guidance. What we want then is the painkiller or the relief. But even then, after a while, you think, you know what, I'm sick of this. I don't want to keep behaving like this anymore because I'm fed up with these outcomes. And then eventually you realize that, and then you get a choice. Do you want to have a spiritual death or a spiritual life or an addict death? And then you think, you know what, I want to follow what the spirit's version of life is. I don't want to keep this self-alcoholic addict self-death life going. I hate it. I hate these consequences, and I know they're coming from these selfish actions. I want to start following the spirit and getting what the spirit has to offer. And then you become a little bit more motivated eventually to say, God, what do you want me to do? Because whatever God wants me to do, that's what I want to do. Anything less than that's going to lead me to suffering, and it may take me years before I realize that. So I'm conceded to my innermost self that I'm a God man. I try and follow God as many times and as many ways as possible. I pray only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out. And that's all I want to do. That's all I'm interested in. I don't argue with anyone about it. I don't care what your philosophy is. I'm not interested. This is what I do. It works great for me. And if you want to help me do this, then wonderful, I'll phone you up. If you don't want to do this or you want to argue with me, leave me alone.
I'm not arguing.
No, but I'm saying, it's working for you. So now you've got to start looking at the corrective measures, because again, infantry without corrective measures is pointless. But there's going to be corrective measures, and you know they're going to grow and grow. There's going to be a lot of things that you're going to help to develop you, especially out of the codependency. That's codependency is like an invisible enemy. It takes a long time to be able to actually see that. I'm pretty sure if I did these groups like we're doing now and we just focused on codependency, it may take like 2 years to get everyone to understand what it actually is, like in a complete way. Because there's so many blocks in you that are actually stop you from, he says, don't pass this way. That most of that pain and uncomfortable feelings we have is actually a good thing. It's actually saying, don't pass this way. Because if you pass this way, you're going to get the truth. You know, it's almost like the disease, or I like the word devil because it fits for me. It's like he's always there making you suffer because he knows if he can make you suffer and you're selfish, you're not going to want to go through the suffering. So you're not going to get to the truth. The truth's on the other side of the suffering. It says in all the spiritual teachings that pain is the touchstone of spiritual growth. I don't like pain. That's why I take painkillers all my life. And it's like, yeah, but you know what? If you don't go through some of that pain, the pleasure that you're looking for And what you're really looking for is on the other side of that pain, but you're going to have to go through it. You ain't going to have to go through it alone. And so, you know, I've learned that in my life, that the more I'm willing to go through the pain, then the more I get to the other side and I find myself on the other side of the pain. The pain keeps you from yourself because the pain is yourself, but it's a part of yourself that you're constantly rejecting. And so really, without guidance, and, you know, it even says a solitary self-appraisal is not going to be enough. We need somebody that, you know, that understands, look, you need to go along this process. It's going to be difficult, but you need to stay in there. You need to stay in there, especially with the fear. It's like you've got to keep feeling that fear, but do it anyway. But then with the direction, then the fear starts to lose its power over you. And so does codependency. So does resentment. So does all kinds of problems start losing their power over us when we stop empowering them and start actually become willing to experience it. And start breaking it down. So I'd say then, well done. Thank you for the demonstration about the work of 12-step program.
Well, it's nice. It's just lovely to feel that I've got something from it. And obviously, that's what sharing's all about at the end of the day, isn't it? For someone else to get something from it too.
And if you keep practicing it, you'll get better and better and better at it. And it'll become a working part of your mind. And then you can help other people learn it just for the simple fact, if nothing else, it works if you work it.
Because you're worth it.
Not just a catchy little thing we say at meetings. It's actually a statement of fact. Thanks a lot.
Jodie's next. Thank you. There we
go. I have a slightly self-centered question and then another one. So the self-centered one is, on Wednesday, when I spoke about the fears worksheet that I'd done, at the end of it, you said to me, and stay abstinent. Did you mean from men and relationships, or did you mean from alcohol? Because my self-centered head was thinking that you thought I was on the brink of a relapse.
No, I meant from stay abstinent from unhealthy relationships.
Oh, okay. All right, good. I did. I spoke to my sponsor about it because she was on the meeting as well, and she said that you meant the same thing, but my head had sort of automatically gone to you thinking I was on the verge of a breakdown.
Okay. But even that's interesting, the fact that that's what your head would think.
Well, I know, and now I've been worrying for the last 2 days that maybe I am on the verge of a breakdown.
Yeah, well, remember that voice.
Yeah.
Remember not to listen to it, because you've got to remember that voice and what and the structure that it brings to you. See, it's always going to do that at certain points, but you've got to learn to become accustomed to that process of thought, because that voice was your addiction. That voice that said he thinks you're going to have a relapse, that made you feel like that. That voice is your addiction.
Okay.
That's the voice you've got to learn to listen to and shut up as quickly as you can.
Okay, thank you. And then the other question, which I know does come up quite a bit in sort of recovery, but I am still on quite a high dose of antidepressants, which I do want to come off. I've spoken to my doctor about it twice, and she sort of said on both occasions that she didn't think it was the right time. I was a nurse. Now, I know the kind of detox that they would put you on with them and the weaning to come off of them, and I have been considering just doing it myself if they keep saying no. But would you say that being on antidepressants to an extent is a kind of false recovery, because you are still putting something in yourself that is changing a chemical balance in your brain, or is changing the way that you feel?
Well, just want to even add a little bit more to the unhealthy relationship. Even that voice in your own head is an unhealthy relationship, that voice that says that to you. So that's the first relationship you've got to start to get right.
Okay.
Now, to move on to the antidepressants, this is a very difficult subject without laying a strong foundation, because don't want anybody to think that we're telling them to come off their medication all of a sudden, because it's not good for you, because people become very heavily dependent on that medication. So heavily dependent on a medication you don't need isn't a good thing.
Yeah.
But having dependence on a medication you do need is a good thing. Now, but then medications are definitely going to affect your state of mind. And they're not going to allow your mind to grow as it would without them. But actually, people that have been on them for many years without getting... I think most of them antidepressants, especially with people with addiction are concerned, are given because of lack of better treatments.
Yeah.
So you go in a doctor's office and in a very short time, he diagnoses you with an emotional or mental problem when really they're not even trained psychiatrists. And then they're going to give you very high-powered medication that's really not meant for you to spend the rest of your life on.
Mm.
There's meant to be other treatments that go alongside that. And so I'm not against medication. I just think it's being used in a very mindless way. Now, even if they said that to people, say, look, what would really help you is a lot more emotional support, you know, some more therapy, you know, some more exercise. I mean, do you mind me asking how long you've been on them?
About 5.5-6 years, but it actually, they got up the dose. They, when I went into my final detox, they said to me, do you want to come off them completely or we can up them? And of course, at the time I asked to up them, but they tripled them. And then I've sort of ended up stuck on that dose.
Right. Has anyone asked you how many cups of coffee that you drink?
Yes.
What, in doctor surgery?
Yeah, they told me to cut down like my caffeine intake and that kind of stuff. But
did they ask you how many Red Bulls you're drinking?
No.
Did they ask you how much sugar that you're taking?
No.
Did they ask you how much exercise you're doing?
No.
Right, so again, we could go on and on and on with things that I would have thought that they would have at least said, try cutting back on all of this before we give you that. See, so even that tells me that's a bit mindless, because you can, most people, when you ask, say, did you even ask how many coffees that you're drinking? Because look, what I've noticed, the people in recovery, is they drink a lot of coffee. I did in the beginning. I used to shake. But you may drink 10 cups of coffee in a day, drink 2 energy drinks, drink 2 cans of Coke. You may have 2 spoonfuls of coffee in your coffee cup with 3 sugars. So over the years, I've actually said to people, like, how many Mars bars you've had? And I've taken them into our kitchen and I've said, right, get a couple of bowls. How many coffees you have? So then I spoon the coffee out, and then that's how many coffees are in Red Bull. That's how many sugars in a Mars bar. That's how many sugars in your tea. Now, just based on them 2 stimulants, again, this isn't across the board for everybody, but that's not my point. My point is like, look, if I drunk that much coffee and consumed that much sugar, I can guarantee you I'm going to be anxious and I'm going to be depressed. That's a guarantee.
Yeah. Like, I was quite surprised when, because it was in an addiction dependency unit that tripled the dose. And at the time, you know, I was only a couple of days into the detox, and I think offering anyone with addiction to get off their meds or up them. At that time, I just wanted to up them because I thought it would just stop me feeling anything. But then I've ended up sort of stuck on them now.
Well, I think that's kind of where I was going with that. Again, it's like, I'm not against it. What I'm against is the mindless side of it. So to say to people, look, because we can't give you better treatments, we're going to give you painkiller.
Yeah.
But really, you need to go and seek them better treatments.
Hmm.
Because when we can find the source of the pain, look, again, if you've got like, a chemical imbalance in your brain, which most people don't have, See, most people come and say, oh, I've got depression because I'm taking antidepressants. It's like, well, I think we need to qualify that, that you're depressed doesn't mean you've got depression. Depression, I'd see more as it's like a mental, as a chemical imbalance in your brain that has nothing to do with nothing. It's just you're something wrong in your chemical makeup. And then the antidepressant rectifies that problem. So for them people, the depression is the chemical alteration of the brain, that their brain is being chemically altered by the depression. So when they take the antidepressant, it chemically alters their brain back to the parameters of roughly a normal brain. But when you've got a normal brain and then you take a drug, the drug chemically alters the brain. See what I'm saying? So it puts you in a chemically altered state because you didn't have a chemical imbalance to begin with. So if you've not got a chemical imbalance to begin with, why am I giving you a drug that alters a chemical imbalance? Now, you have got a chemical imbalance in the sense of you're not producing very much serotonin. Now, it's not that you're not capable of producing it. It's just the mental thought process you have is not producing enough serotonin. So your brain's capable of producing serotonin if you learn to change the way you think. But when you think like an alcoholic and think like an addict, it's not going to produce much serotonin. It's called hedonia, and it means you get like a pleasure deafness. You're not happy. So when they give you antidepressants, they're giving you serotonin. And then they think, well, that's going to make you feel happy. But it doesn't really, does it? And then people think, well, but you know, I was a lot more unhappy before I was taking it. And if I stop taking it now, I'm going to be unhappy. And it's like, well, you probably are going to be unhappy if you never change your thinking, because certain thoughts that you have create peptides that create serotonin that send peptides into your body that dock on your receptors and make you feel okay. So we believe we can change your thinking through our programs and processes that give you the chemicals that you're lacking by that negative thinking. So I'm always trying to change somebody's thinking. I know myself. I can feel incredibly depressed, incredibly angry, incredibly resentful, and in 1 second somebody can go, Lester, let it go. The moment I let it go, I feel okay. Yeah. Now I know when I go into the doctor's office and say I feel depressed, he's going to give me antidepressants. I don't agree with. So based on that reasoning, it's to say you need to find somebody, get a good therapist and a good doctor.
Okay.
And start work and a good program. And as you start working on your program, but again, if you're dependent on that medication, there's that bridge. You've got this bridge from being on medication where your brain has to come off of it so it can start reproducing and change your thinking, so you start getting the good chemicals. So that's the thing about prescription drugs. They're so powerful and so highly addictive. I'll say this, that we can get someone off heroin in 10 days. It takes like 6 months to get them off of the Valiums and antidepressants. And then the journey kind of begins at the end of 6 months. And they're banging their heads off the walls because it takes so long for their brain to pick up naturally to be able to start producing enough serotonin for themselves. And that's quite a difficult journey. And without the right support and enough support, you're just not going to get through. That's kind of what makes recovery work. That's kind of what we're saying. It's not just having a program. It's also having a good fellowship around you that know the program, that can give you the support. Because again, one of the things we can do as human beings, we can support each other's brains. But when I'm in, got strong recovery in my mind and somebody phones me up, then I use my mind to try and talk recovery into their mind. And if they trust me, their mind opens up. They give themselves to my thinking or recovery thinking, and their brains open up. So, you know, when we learn to listen to each other and have a good recovery, we can support each other's mental health. Or you can do the reverse. If people just want to talk about drinking drugs and what it used to be like and how much I smoked and who I smoked it with, you just keep promoting the illness in their mind. But when we start actually talking about recovery, we start creating an environment that supports the development of recovery. And so get good recovery around you, deal with some of them issues, get yourself in a healthy place where you're exercising and eating right and cutting a lot of that stimulants out of your life, and then start reducing with the aid of the doctor. And it doesn't matter how long it takes, because some of it's going to be pretty uncomfortable. But, you know, when I'm helping people do that, I like to sort of bring them down. If they feel too uncomfortable, let them plateau a little bit, because you've got to be a bit uncomfortable, because you're going to be uncomfortable until you develop a bit. That's the trouble when you come off drinking drugs, when you kind of puts her in, you know, let's say that's your nervous system and it's like a hair and it pings, and as it pings, it gathers information. That's what your nervous system does. It's kind of collecting information. But if it's super sensitive because it hasn't developed, you're going to be like a super sensitive person. And then when you actually go through life and have experiences, it kind of puts a natural insulation on your emotions. So your emotions can still feel what's going on in the world, and it can still gather all the information that it needs for you to gather so you can respond. But it's not super sensitive. Some of our senses are super sensitive, and some of us are, you know, really sensitive in certain areas, but that's because we're gathering good information. But when you've like not developed a good coating on your nervous system through dysfunction or whatever you've been doing, and then you go to the doctor and he can see you're super sensitive, he's going to give you a painkiller which puts a synthetic insulation on your nervous system. It pain kills you. And now the goal is you've got to remove that painkiller slowly so it can start pinging that nervous system again. And then slowly what replaces that, and this is what the bridge to recovery is, the bridge to normal living, is that as we're allowing that slowly to ping, your nervous system is then starting to naturally develop its own insulation. And then you become less sensitive as time goes on. So that's the gap now you've got to work on. How do I remove the synthetic insulation just enough to allow nature to start making me less sensitive? But it means there's a period, the bridge to normal living, it can be a little bit uncomfortable. But like we said, the touchstone to spiritual growth is a bit of discomfort. If we allow that discomfort and stop trying to painkill ourselves, then we do grow a healthy amount of insulation and a stronger nervous system, and then we can start coping better with life. You know, it's a funny thing. I was just talking to a couple of people yesterday, but they're like, and I feel the same myself. It's like, God, it's being at home. He's like, I just don't feel like I'm usually peaceful in my life. And I'm like, well, at home on your own you are. But what about when you're out there dealing with the world and other people? They're like, well, that's a bit different. And I'm like, yeah, because that's taxing your nervous system. And so most of us, you know, I know it's in addiction, because can have a very underdeveloped nervous system, is that we try and then avoid things in life. And because they're uncomfortable, things like relationships and, you know, things that we'd want to do. And then we sort of become content of staying away from life because it makes us feel a bit more comfortable. And then I think that can, you know, it can be a little bit sad sometimes, because then people do end up very lonely and very unfulfilled. And then I talk to people that I know that are sort of been in recovery a lot of years, and when they're coming near the end of their life, they say, I feel unsatisfied. And I think that's such a sad thing for me, because I feel satisfied with my life, because I've had quite an incredible life. I feel that when people get near the end of their life, I know they've only got one life, and they felt that they haven't done what they wanted to do because they were just trying to be safe and comfortable, or they didn't have the ability to fall in love and things like that. But then they feel that they weren't satisfied with their life. And I think that is such a sad state of affairs, because I believe in my faith, that God said he wants me to be satisfied with my life. So that's an important thing. Satisfaction's important. We all want to be satisfied, don't we? Kind of what we're all looking for. And there's nothing wrong in that. There's nothing wrong in expecting to be satisfied in your relationship, in your job, in your house, with yourself. You know, it's important to people. It's important to God. So a bit of a process, but we've probably got a doctor that started working for us that you may have to pay, but it may be good to talk to her. She really is a psychologist and she's a treatment. She understands addiction and she may be somebody good to talk to that can give you a good process along with working with therapists. Because doctors are not trained in that. They're trained on putting you on. They don't know how to get you off. They hate it. It's crazy.
Thank you. Well, it's 2 minutes to noon. I think we have time for one more, if somebody wants to put their hand up. Oh, I've got Anthony there, waving at the screen. There we go, mate.
Hi there, thanks, Fox. Yeah, I just wanted to talk. You've spoke quite a lot, you know, on an individual when we spoke in person, Lester, and also in groups. 10 years ago, when I had 5 years of good recovery and a really good approach to it, but it kind of tapered off into a superficial approach, and I paid the consequences for that and began drinking, which was never my solution to my problem, which my point is, the problem now, as I understand it, for a very traumatic experience as a spiritual malady, and I see that resentment and fears and anger and all of these are a manifestation of that spiritual malady. And I came up with this over the last maybe few months, if not a couple of years, that I came to realize that I'm, and it's quite a strong statement, but I'm just tormented to be in this skin. I'm tormented by existence, which is quite a strong thing. And if someone had said that to me 10 years ago, I'd be like, I don't really understand what you mean by that. But it took me a lot of years to realize that that's how deep the spiritual malady goes. Is it normal for it to take so many years to come to that deep realization, if that makes sense?
No, you got to be really stupid.
Thanks for that. Moving on.
I'll chop that out, next. Anthony.
Next. Well, I think that's not true. I was obviously joking then. Yeah. I think what it is, mate, again, this is the only way that I can see it, is that what you're talking about then, it's about a deep relationship.
With myself.
So that when a lot of us are not capable of that for one reason or another, whether that's there's actually something deeply wrong with us, I think people with addiction are born with the potential to become addicts, and then something upsets them. It could be a trauma, but I don't think the trauma is the real problem. It's just the identifier, if anything. It shows how sensitive we become. Something in us sort of shuts down a bit, and then relationships become very difficult. And then, ultimately, we become separated from our core, because I think having a healthy development would actually make the connections, you know, if your parents really understand about themselves and about life and about probably God or the universe or, you know, just your human spirit, they would help you make kind of healthy connections. So I think that for people that especially come from dysfunctional kind of backgrounds, that saying, look, the fact that you're like this is you're not having a very healthy relationship. That's what the separation is. You know, the separation is an unhealthy relationship. So we try forming all these unhealthy relationships to try and resolve this feeling of not being in a healthy relationship with ourselves. But then when you come into recovery, and then we go, look, we need to set you back on this journey to have this relationship with yourself to sort this spiritual malady out, then that journey on the way back may be fraught with all kinds of harm and fear and things that we don't want to deal with, but that tends to happen subconsciously. And so that's why I think that most people like yourself, you come into recovery in a very extreme situation, you get a kind of, you start basically working the steps, but there's no way you can work them kind of properly because you wouldn't know them, and you're only going to pick bits out, and most people around you don't really seem to know them that well either. And then we get this kind of superficial recovery that sort of says, well, I don't really have to make them amends because that would have meant I would have to really address this relationship problem. So we try and find ways around that. And again, I think because it's kind of a mass problem that mostly doing, we start then going into just getting on with our lives, thinking that we're going to be all right when we get a career, when we get a family, when we get kids, when we get this, when we get that. But you're kind of like a perfect example of that. And again, look, the statistics that I'm aware of say this. The next biggest relapse after the first year is year 7 to 9. And it's not necessarily because people are doing badly externally. It's because they've not dealt with the underlying problem, but it can take sort of anywhere from 5 to 10 years for you to kind of exhaust everything externally and then realize, hang on a minute, I'm still left with this spiritual malady, this deep sense that there's something wrong, that I'm separated from myself, that in a way it's like your spirit's over here and your head's over here. And see, that's an unhealthy relationship when your head's over here and your spirit's over there. And it's only when you start getting them lined up that you start getting your head, which is kind of like your thought process, and your body or your emotions start getting in line. That's when you start feeling, hang on a minute, I'm having a better relationship with myself now, because all the parts of you are starting to work together rather than arguing all the time. Because most people's heads and bellies don't match up. Because most people, when they say, oh, I don't know what to do, it's like, yes, you do. Your belly's, what's your belly telling you? And they're like, well, I don't want to do that because of this. So, you know, most people are actually arguing with themselves. You know, a lot of the time when you're doing this program, you're just trying to tell me what to do. It's like, mate, I promise you, your gut is telling you the same thing. You just don't want to do what yourself's telling you. No wonder you're so conflicted all the time and unhappy, because all that suffering that you're feeling is yourself. You're blaming everyone else for. All of that fear's coming out of yourself. Most of your problems are being caused by your own actions, but you still want to blame everybody else. Your head's over here, your heart's over there. No wonder you're not happy. You're completely out of line, which is what we say, isn't it? They're out of line. When you get in line, when you get the director and the body right, and you start following, so the program kind of help you do that. So I think what does that, mate, is it's the relationship. This is all about getting in a committed relationship with yourself. That's what we're trying to say about this process. It's saying, unless you can commit yourself to recovery, to this relationship, you're not going to do very well. It is about learning to get in a committed relationship. Well, what you try and do then is if you're not in a committed relationship, you tend to then want a relationship with everything else other than that. Anything but that. And so, you know, a lot of the time people, that when they actually do come back, like yourself, it's because you've tried everything else. Now it's like, come back to that now. And it works, doesn't it? So just undo your mic a minute, Anthony.
Yeah.
So even like you kind of fitted in the profile that you would expect to somebody like you to be. Oh, you've gone mic'd up again.
It was off. Yeah, it kind of makes sense, you know, because looking back, my mum and dad, they catered for me materially, partly emotionally, but anything on a deep level, especially with my dad, was just not catered for at all. So I didn't develop emotionally or any sort of, you know, spiritual or philosophical exploration or growth in my family was non-existent. My dad probably couldn't even tell you what philosophical meant, let alone, you know, or spiritual. And I believe that was a deep thing missing within me. Because interestingly, you said you don't necessarily think people are born with addiction. And now I've always think I don't think I was born with it. You know, it certainly isn't in my family. I am the first and hopefully the last one.
I think you're born potentially. It doesn't actually. It's like if you're born with a peanut allergy, but it doesn't actually. You can't get sick until you actually eat a peanut. So I think it's the same with this. It's like you're born in a certain way. And then when something happens, then it triggers it off. See, but even that is like, so what you were saying there, you didn't then really follow through with your steps. So you're still holding resentment, but you're probably trying to avoid that subconsciously, actually dealing with it. And then a lot of us trying to go in denial of it. We try and learn to live with it. You know, dysfunction is a difficult thing. Most of us try and learn to live with it, and then we realise after some years, I can't live with this. And then at some point, you're like, but it's too overwhelming. This is too overwhelming to fix. Because it just doesn't affect me. This is everyone around me is going to have an effect on them. So we try an easy, softer way. And then I think you get the point, it's like, man, I need to try and recover from this. I can't live with this anymore. And I think that's when you really start getting into so again, you can, it's what I'm saying about people thinking not drinking is the event. Because then they miss, there's this whole process with all this other underlying issues. But if they think not drinking is the main event, they think they're all right when they're not drinking. But it's like, no, that's just the symptom of the underlying stuff. And then they start trying to live with all their dysfunction. And it's like, you know, it appears like some people are kind of getting away with it, but that's one of the things of being around recovery for like 3 decades. You watch what happens to all of them people. And a lot of them get really ill. They don't all drink again, but they get really ill, really depressed, really unhappy. They live on their own, a lot of them. Or they live in really grumpy relationships. Because they're still suffering from the mental condition that's never been treated. Because society hasn't really got its head around it yet. And, you know, that's kind of what happens to people like you. But the thing is, it does take that good 10 years to get to that point where you got to. So, and then you come back to the program, start doing the program, and then what happened?
Well, yeah. So I don't even want to, I certainly feel better, but it's interesting on the point of, I'm generally not that happy, but I've been happy and I realised that it's temporary, it's fleeting, and it's just because of an external event. But what I have got over the last few weeks, when I rang you just after Christmas, is just a feeling of relative stability and a subtle joy of life again. And I'm okay with that. I don't really want a lot more than that. And there are some very weightful resentments that I have to deal with.
Yeah, and again, I think you'd find it hard to find anybody that's actually feeling happy at the minute for any long period of time. The world we're in at the moment, isn't it? Mm. Yeah. All right, cheers, mate.